Welcome to the Wealth is in the Details podcast. In this podcast, financial planner Peter Raskin helps families and business owners understand and prepare for their wealth journey. Along the way, thoughtful and detailed planning can provide clarity and confidence as clients confront a multitude of financial decisions. Listen in as Peter shares stories and insight into people's wealth journeys. Now, let's get into today's podcast.
Peter Raskin is teaching us about the language investment professionals speak. In part one of this two-part series, we covered several concepts, including average return, standard deviation, market cap-weighted index, and more. This time around, and the wealth is in the details, we have many more concepts to cover. I'm Patrice Sikora. And Peter, as I said, we have many more, so where do you want to start?
Well, thanks, Patrice. This is part two. And for those listeners, I think it would be helpful to go back to part one if you've not heard it, because some of these concepts kind of build on each other. But this could be a standalone listen as well. So I just wanted to make that point. Patrice, thanks. Along the lines of trying to help our clients understand the jargon of investments, mm-hmm. I thought I'd spend some time talking about kind of how we define some of the different kinds of stocks out there. And, you know, many of our clients think they are diversified because they own lots of different kinds of stocks. But what tends to happen is that many of us own stocks that are doing kind of similar things. Mm. And so in general, the investment world has been kind of trying to separate the stocks or slice and dice them in a way that makes sense. So one way to slice and dice the stock market is to put different kinds of companies that have certain things in common together with other stocks that have similar issues or things that they do. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm going to do is talk about growth stocks versus value stocks.
We've been hearing a lot about those two words lately too.
Yeah. So I think it's helpful. Just in my belief is that we, in order to diversify a portfolio, we probably want some of both. We want both growth stocks and value stocks in a portfolio. So, but first, let's define what that means. So growth stocks are stocks that are expected to grow faster than other kinds of stocks. They typically don't pay dividends because they're reinvesting their earnings. They may be growing quickly. They might be more leveraged than other companies, meaning they are borrowing funds to spend on growing their business. These companies are often in the communication services sector, the technology sector, healthcare, and consumer discretionary. Those tend to be growth sectors of the economy. And those companies, again, tend to be hopefully growing fast and faster, mm-hmm. compared to what we call value stocks. And these are stocks that typically are more stable than growth stocks. It doesn't mean that they don't go up and down in value. They certainly do. The value stocks often pay dividends, and the price per share relative to the earnings of the company is lower than growth stocks. Growth stocks may not have a lot of current earnings. Value stocks have current earnings, and the price you have to pay for those future earnings is reasonable, at least relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. So you know, what industries are value stocks? Well, they happen to be industrial companies, financial companies, banks, insurance companies, maybe energy companies, manufacturing, real estate companies are often value stocks. Utilities pay dividends.
Right, right.
You know, consumer staples. These are typical value stocks. And it's important to own, I think, both. And it's cyclical. Growth stocks can do well in certain economic environments, and their stock prices can go up pretty significantly. And then in other environments, value stocks tend to outperform. just as an example, we've seen this recently. Growth stocks have done very, very well recently, but in 2020, growth stocks didn't do very well relative to value stocks. And this can, again, is cyclical. We'll have long periods of time where value stocks outperform growth stocks and long periods of time where growth stocks outperform value stocks. In the recent 10 years, 12 years, growth stocks have significantly outperformed value stocks. But that may be because we were in such a very low interest rate environment. There are other factors that drove that. And remember, these growth stocks are often borrowing money to leverage and to grow their businesses. Well, interest rates were very low for a long period of time, and that may have been part of that reason. But in any event, it happens both ways. What does this mean for investors? Is that diversification means you should own both. We just don't know which stocks are going to outperform or underperform in any given periods of time. So we want exposure to both. We want to take advantage of the earnings. We want to take advantage of the dividends that the value stocks provide. We want the growth and the appreciation of growth stocks. And just it makes sense to own both at the same time if we want to diversify.
And you mentioned cyclical. Factor investing also is cyclical. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Factor investing is a similar conversation to growth and value, but I think it's a little bit more fine-tuned. It's an investment approach that involves looking at specific drivers of returns across different asset classes. And so what are these drivers? I'll talk about that in a second, but there are two main types of factors that we look at, that investment firms look at. And that one is macroeconomic factors and the other is style factors. And when we're investing in factors, the idea here is that we're choosing factors that make a difference. They can improve portfolio outcomes. They can reduce volatility. They might be able to enhance diversification. And the same with really the conversation that we've had about growth and value stocks, and as well as in the previous podcast that we did about kind of this jargon. We're talking about long term periods of time, not short term. Short term, you know, these factors may not influence us as much, but long term factors can make a difference. So I wanted to briefly talk about macroeconomic factors. And these are things like the business cycle or economic growth. You know, are businesses growing? Are they shrinking? Real rates, and here I'm talking about real rates of interest. You know, changes in interest rates. We've recently had a huge spike in inflation. Interest rates went up dramatically. We've had interest rates come down recently. We've also seen inflation, which is basically a change in prices that we all pay. That's gone up and down as well. Credit is a macroeconomic factor. You know, credit, and here I'm talking about the default risk that we have from lending to companies. If we're lending to companies that are having financial difficulties, there's risk. And then we've got another factor called emerging markets.
Right.
And here we got, you know, political and sovereign risk, you know, country risk. If you're investing in parts of the world that might be having problems, whether that's a China, whether that's a Russia. You know, these are companies with significant risk, both politically and you know, economically. And then the last factor from a macroeconomic perspective is liquidity. How quickly can you raise cash? And liquidity is always an important issue. So those are macroeconomic factors that we take that into account. There are also stylistic or style factors. And here we're talking about the styles that can make a difference. And what we've seen over a long period of time is that value stocks that are discounted from a price standpoint relative to their fundamentals or to their earnings, tend to have good performance. Those companies where there's less volatility, we call these minimum volatility factors, where we're trying to build a basket of stocks that tend to not go up and down as much. And they can be, they that can be a, that can be positive for portfolios. Stocks with a significant upward price trend, you know, we call those momentum stocks. You know, these stocks tend to move up together. It's a momentum. It's kind of like, there's the wind's at their back, and and other investors are buying because the wind's at their back. And that's an important benefit to certain stocks. So we can actually slice and dice and look for stocks that are what we call momentum stocks. And then quality, you know, we want to buy companies that are financially healthy. Over a long period of time, financially healthy companies do quite well. Firms that are well managed, have less risk, have good earnings, they tend to continue to do well. And that's a factor that we can screen for. And then finally, size matters. Over a long period of time, small companies tend to outperform large mega companies. Now, we don't see that all the time. Again, it's cyclical. But over a long period of time, small company stocks tend to do well, maybe more volatile, but they tend to appreciate very well. Again, not in all circumstances. So again, factor performance is cyclical, and it's important. And their investment firms are often tilting their investment portfolios toward factors that can make a difference based on the style that they think is going to be helped by macroeconomic factors. And so you can see how by slicing and dicing into parts of the market that are going to hopefully achieve good returns, maybe at less with less risk, a portfolio can do well, can meet expectations. And that's the goal. It doesn't always work. I think that's the, and we're talking long-term. We're not talking short-term, but long-term, these investing factors make a difference.
These seem to be a little more sophisticated than what you've been talking about in the past.
Yeah, really. And it is. Not all firms can do this because they don't have the capacity, they don't have the expertise, but they are part of many, many discussions and many, many portfolios that we're reviewing. So the tilting based upon what's going on in the market, it happens. Tilting doesn't mean you throw out the you throw out everything. It just means maybe you add a little bit more to a certain style factor that might make a difference. So what is it? What does it mean? This means that hopefully over a long period of time, you meet expectations. Maybe you'll do a little bit better than you expect, better than the market as a whole. And I just wanted to point out that because it's more sophisticated, these things aren't free. Investment firms are charging for these kinds of sophisticated analytical approaches. And it may be worthwhile to pay that.
Hi, this is Catherine Broy from the Raskin Planning Group. Apologies for the interruption. Thanks so much for listening to Wealth is in the Details. We hope you're enjoying it so far. If you have any questions or would like to talk more about this topic, please visit our website at www.raskinplanning.com. Look for the podcast's show notes and connect with us via social media.
All right. We're moving on to a phrase that has been in the news a lot in the last year or so, yield curve. Yield curve and duration.
Yeah, here this part of the conversation is more about bonds, and so yield curve. Think about a graph where the horizontal value is the maturity of the bond, the length of the maturity, and the vertical is the interest rate for that bond. And I want to give some examples. Mm-hmm. U.S. Treasuries have maturities that can range from 1 month to 30 years, and I looked as of February 1st, 2024, the 1 month treasury was yielding 5.49%. The one-year bond was earning 4.68%. And the five-year bond was yielding only 3.8%. And the 30-year bond was yielding 4.1%.
Wait a minute. That doesn't seem logical.
Well, it's what we call an inverted yield curve when short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. It's unusual. It doesn't happen all the time. In most economic periods, long-term interest rates are actually higher than short-term rates, but that's where we are right now. And because of this inverted yield curve, there are some prognosticators, but they predict that this means a recession is in our future. And frankly, I happen to agree with them. A recession is always in our future. We just don't know when.
So true.
So we've been talking about this recession for a long time. We've not seen it recently. It may come sooner than later, but we don't know. And I'm not here to predict it. But I will say this, predicting interest rates is really tough to do, and it's really tough to do consistently well. So, but right now we are in an inverted yield curve, and the yield curve is important. It's important to understand where we sit from a bond perspective.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. Duration, as defined, is a measure of a fund's interest rate sensitivity.
Hmm.
And it's expressed in years. So what we're trying to do here is understand, what's my risk of owning a bond and selling the bond before it matures? So the longer a fund's duration, the more sensitive the fund is to the shifts in interest rates. It's a formula. It's a calculation. I'm not here to talk about the formula, but we take a look when we're trying to figure out duration, we're looking at the interest rate or the coupon and when that bond matures. So low interest rates and long maturities tend to increase duration, while short maturities and high interest rates or coupons shorten duration. So that's kind of the relationship. And it's kind of straightforward. A fund with a duration of 10 years is twice as volatile as a fund with a five-year duration. And that doesn't mean that the investor might lose money. It just means if they try to sell the bond before the bonds mature, they may get more or less than the price they purchased for it. So what does this mean for investors? Well, we don't recommend trying to predict the direction of interest rates. I just think that's a losing proposition. And typically we're recommending portfolios that have a lot of different durations, some short and others longer. You know, if we're buying bonds because they tend to be a lower risk asset class and the correlation is low relative to stocks, we want to buy quality bonds with typically shorter and intermediate term durations. They right now they're offering reasonable income, and without all the interest rate risk of going long term. So it's 10 what we see short and intermediate term durations make sense. But when you hear that word, it's all about maturity and interest rates.
All right. Well, bonds it is. Let's continue with bonds. Investment grade versus high yield.
Yeah, not all bonds are the same. It's kind of for the same reasons we diversify our stock holdings. Oftentimes, investors want to diversify into different types of bonds. You know, just as a reminder, when you're buying a bond, you're lending money to an institution, and they're promising to pay you back your principal at a certain point in time. And between that purchase date of the bond and the maturity date of your bond, the entity is going to pay you a predetermined interest rate each year. So that's what a bond is. It's just you're lending money. And the safest bonds are those that are guaranteed by the U.S. government, which kind of makes sense. And the only risk to the investor is the interest rate risk. If interest rates go up before the bond matures, the investor is locked into a lower rate than they might be able to get if they were to buy a new bond. But if they try to sell that bond before it matures, they might not receive the same price they paid for it. if bond interest rates go down, the investor might be happy keeping the bond. But if they try to sell this bond, they might get a higher price than the initial cost for the bond. So it's a double-edged sword. We tend to try to think about bonds as you want to buy bonds to maturity, hold them to maturity.
Right, right.
So those are your all bonds. When we're bonds are classified by credit rating agencies like Standard & Poor, like Moody's, another firm called Fitch. And what they do is they analyze certain bonds and they rate them either low risk or high risk. And bonds that are rated at least triple B are classified as investment grade bonds. And those bonds rated lower than triple B are classified as high yield bonds. High yield bonds are basically you're taking on more credit risk than investment grade bonds. Investment grade bonds are safer. They typically offer lower interest rates than high yield bonds, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you're a company and your rating, your financial situation isn't quite as strong, you're going to have to offer a higher interest rate for investors for them to buy to lend you money. That just again makes sense. High yield bonds tend to have lower credit risk and higher yields. The good thing is most government bonds are classified as investment grade bonds, but they can also be high yield bonds. I think that's important information. So, you know, for example, U.S. bonds are investment grade, while bonds issued by, you know, a country like Venezuela might be classified as high yield or even very high yield bonds.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of credit risk in countries like that.
Right.
So what does this mean for investors? You know, during difficult economic periods, high yield bonds might pay high yields, but they have more risk. But when an economy improves or the company becomes stronger, their credit rating could improve. And when this happens, these high yield bonds, they might increase in value. And the reverse can also happen. If the company's credit risk increases, the bonds might drop in value. And so it's important to build a very diversified portfolio of both investment grade and high yield bonds. Depending upon your risk tolerance, you may want many more investment grade bonds. You might not want any high yield bonds. The other point I want to make is that high yield bonds are also tend to be a little bit more correlated to stocks than investment grade bonds.
Well, actually, that would make some sense.
Yeah, exactly. If your company's doing well, their stock price goes up, and maybe they're becoming more financially secure, and therefore their credit rating also goes up, and people are willing to pay more for that bond.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at bonds, you, as you say, they in general, bonds don't quite correlate with what stocks are doing in general. But in the last year or so, we had a very strange situation. Can you talk about that, where stocks and bonds were doing just about the same thing?
They were. In 2022, interest rates went way up. And bond values, if you were trying to sell your bond, went way down. And that at the same time, the stock market did very poorly.
Right.
And so that doesn't happen very often. Most of the time when stocks go down, bonds stay flat. Maybe they go up in value. But most of the time, they act as a great hedge. In 2022, they did not. Again, it doesn't happen often, but it happened. And so that's why we need to diversify. But even saying that, even though bonds had a bad year in 2022, they still did better than stocks did. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, we did have some very strange years there. And hopefully we're not going to see those again.
Well, I think we'll always have strange years. I mean, that's part of being an investor, is dealing with things that are unexpected. expect the unexpected.
Oh, that was that's excellent. You know, Peter, I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've explained so many great things. There are concepts that we've heard the words, but we really may not have known what they meant. So thank you for that. And listeners, you know, oh, before we get going, Peter, how can people reach you if they've got additional questions?
Yeah, probably the best way to reach me is through my website. Go to raskinplanning.com.
All right, there you go. And listeners, if you haven't already, listen to part one of this. And as we said, this is part two. But of course, follow Peter and the Wealth is in the Details podcast. That way you will know when all the episodes are ready for you, and share with others. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth is in the Details podcast. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available.
The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Lincoln Financial Advisors Corp. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning. Peter Raskin is a registered representative of Lincoln Financial Advisors. Securities offered through Lincoln Financial Advisors Corp., a broker-dealer, member SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Sagemark Consulting, a division of Lincoln Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. Insurance offered through Lincoln Affiliates and other fine companies. Raskin Planning Group is a marketing name for registered representatives of Lincoln Financial Advisors. Lincoln Financial Advisors Corporation and its representatives do not provide legal or tax advice. You may want to consult a legal or tax advisor regarding any legal or tax information as it relates to your personal circumstances.